Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a great weekend. Thanks for being with us. Today we are going to continue our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Senator Clarence Lamb, a Democrat, one of several members of the Maryland General Assembly who's running for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. The incumbent, John Sarbanes, will retire from the House of Representatives next January. Senator Lamb is in his second term representing District 12 in the Maryland Senate. When he was first elected in 2019, that district included parts of Baltimore County and Howard County. And after redistricting, he now represents Anne Arundel and Howard counties. He serves on the Finance Committee and he chairs the Joint Committee on Fair Practices and State Personnel Oversight. He's also the Secretary of the Maryland Legislative Asian American and Pacific Islander Caucus. And prior to his election to the Senate, he served in the House of Delegates for one term. Senator Lamb is a physician, board certified in both preventive and occupational medicine. He holds an undergraduate degree from Case Western Reserve University. He received his medical degree from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He also holds a Master of Public Health degree from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. In addition to his legislative work, Dr. Lamb is the director of the Preventive Medicine Residency Program and an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Bloomberg School. He's also the medical director for occupational health at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, where he continues to see patients every week, even when the General Assembly is in session. Clarence Lamb is 43 years old. He and his wife, Sarah, are the parents of a 2-year-old daughter. They live in Columbia. Senator Lamb joins me here in Studio A. We'll take your calls for this, Senator, a little later in the program. You are welcome to join us on email now, that address, midday@wipr.org. Senator, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Happy to be here.
So you are no stranger to Capitol Hill. You worked on Capitol Hill in the early years of your career. You were with Congressman Waxman for a while. You've also worked behind the scenes in the Maryland legislature. What's the appeal of politics in general and of the House of Representatives in particular?
The appeal is that I've always had an interest in serving people in every single thing that I do, particularly as a second generation Asian American immigrant and as a family who grew up here. Realized that there were a lot of people that helped us along the way and helped my family. And that's what inspired me to go to medicine initially, a recognition that there's no more important way to be able to help people than in their health. But it's also what inspired me to go into public policy, a recognition that my family had a lot of opportunities here that they simply wouldn't have had they not been here, to be able to choose what they wanted to do, to say what they wanted to say, plan the activities that they wanted to for us. And that was what really inspired me to want to give back, to help others that are arriving here as well, and to help underrepresented populations, whether that's healthcare professionals, of which there are very few in legislatures, whether that's immigrants, or whether that's scientists. And bringing that perspective to a legislative body like the General Assembly or even like Congress is incredibly important.
You know, going to medical school is not easy. It's a lot of work, you know, and the post-medical school stuff that you've got to go through. And then you went and got a master's in public health on top of all of that. You'd have to walk away from a career in medicine, I would assume. I mean, now you're able to sort of balance your medical work with your legislative work, but that's probably not going to be the case in the House of Representatives. What are the implications of that decision to walk away from something you've worked so hard for over all these years?
I think that stems back to my really deep desire to help people, right? And we realize that while there's a lot that we can do to help people within the walls in the clinic, and I do that every single week, there's so much more that we can help people as well with public policies that we can enact to support our local communities. It was a tough decision. There's no doubt about that. After all the training that you cite, to have to go through medical school and residency and then be able to see patients on your own and balance that with the legislative work that you do recognize that going to Congress is a full-time job, unlike the Maryland General Assembly. And to give that all up, it wasn't simply just a political decision for me, it was also a professional and career decision. But it was a decision in recognition that there's so much more that you can continue to give back. And these opportunities aren't ones that I'm looking for, but they're ones that when they avail themselves, it's important for people that have the right motivation and values to step up into the role. And that's why I'm really proud to be able to run for this office.
I, for one, am always happy when physicians and people in various other careers, other than the law, just the law, decide to seek public office. And in this particular climate, this incredibly bifurcated, very polarized political climate, one of the sources of polarization is people's appreciation for science, for data, for factual bases for things like how to handle pandemics, or how to handle reproductive health, or how to handle a variety of things that affect people literally on a day-to-day basis and literally in a life and death manner. How do you negotiate, or how do you handle the segment of, frankly, the Republican Party that is anti-science, that does not value, does not elevate the work that researchers are doing and that the people with scientific backgrounds are doing?
That's a good question. And for me, I hearken back to my background as a physician. That as a physician, it's really, medicine is in many ways a customer service business. You are there to help people and to serve people. And in that way, it's very similar to the legislative work that we do. But as a physician, we recognize that it's important to be able to sit down, to listen to people, even ones that you don't agree with, even ones that you might be scratching your head wondering, why did you do this or why did you make these choices? But as a doctor, you have to be non-judgmental and you have to realize we're here to solve a problem. We're here to improve your health. And the legislative body, we're here to solve problems too and across our communities. And to be able to find that common ground as a physician, you set aside your biases, you set aside your concerns to really focus on how we can solve problems. And you find that area of overlap where you can come to an agreement on a common goal to quit smoking, to reduce your weight, to eat healthier. And if you can find those areas of overlap, even if with people that you disagree with in the clinic, you can do that in a legislative body too. And that's what I've really focused on doing over the last 9 years in the General Assembly.
Senator Clarence Lamb is my guest. He's also Dr. Clarence Lamb. It's midday today. It's one of our conversations with the candidates. We're talking to the senator about his candidacy in the 3rd Congressional District. Our email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. So I've mentioned to some of your colleagues and other people who are running, not just for the 3rd District Congressional seat, but for seats in other districts as well, about the incredible dysfunction of the current Congress. More than 700 bills proposed, fewer than 30 passed. We've got speaker changes. We've got now another threat for yet another vote on the current speaker's tenure. For you, if you're elected to Congress, if you get through the primary and you win the general election, what does success look like?
I think success looks like being able to work with others to get things done. As you mentioned, Congress these days is very dysfunctional, but I still believe that one person can make a significant difference impact. And everything starts with one person in a legislative body, whether that's one person coming up with an idea, one person putting a bill in, one person planting a seed to make it a budget priority. I have faith that one person is still able to make significant change, but that starts by listening to other people. That starts by being able to empathize with others, putting yourself into other people's shoes, similar work that I do as a physician, but be able to hear them out, even folks that you don't disagree with, to find that common ground to work on something. And whether that's a policy that you ordinarily wouldn't agree with someone on, but you maintain your values, if you can find some area that you agree upon, that overlap in the Venn diagram in the middle, that's a great starting place to be able to work on legislation and hopefully build a level of trust, which is what we need right now these days in Congress, to restore trust in those members, restore trust in our legislators. And I think as a physician, we carry the community's trust, and I hope to be able to bring that trust to Congress as well, to be able to work with others and build those relationships as a starting point for us to accomplish more.
What's the source of the distrust, in your view? Is it distrust that nothing will get done because people are so ossified in their positions? Is it distrust that they're willing to work across the aisle, or is it something deeper? What do you think? How do you analyze it?
I think it's a combination of things. I think there is a culture these days in Congress to not talk to the other side. that everything becomes a zero-sum game, that if you win, I lose. And that wasn't how Congress used to be. When I worked with Congressman Henry Waxman in the U.S. House of Representatives in his health oversight office, we recognized that there were still places where you could work together on. And there still are. Those are far fewer in between these days. But we have to make the effort to reach across to our colleagues, many of whom you might disagree with very fundamentally. But if you can find some common ground to work from, that's one way to be able to start. The other piece, too, is that for many of these districts, they have become very gerrymandered. And that has resulted in members not having to speak to the other side or under risk, as you mentioned, under threat, that if you do speak with other colleagues, that you could be voted out of office. In a legislative body, if you can't talk to each other, you can't function. And that's what we're seeing these days. And that's why we need to send folks that can restore trust in our legislative body in Congress to be able to represent their communities there.
How do you explain to voters what distinguishes you in this huge field? There are 22 people running for the seat that you're seeking in the House of Representatives. And however this works out, of the 10 people in the Maryland congressional delegation, two senators and eight people in the House, four, almost half, are going to be new one way or the other because there are four open seats. So it's going to be a very new era for Maryland politics and for Maryland's representation on Capitol Hill. What makes you different than the other 22 who have the same aspiration?
It's a good question. I think my background as a physician, particularly as a public health physician, is really unique. As a public health doctor, we recognize that there's so much that plays into people's health that extend beyond the walls of the clinic and the hospital, that their educational level factors into their health, their access to good transportation, the air that they breathe, the water that they drink, the environment certain plays to their health, having adequate housing plays in their health. There are very few doctors in Congress. There are only 15 in the U.S. House of Representatives, of which only four are Democrats, and none of which have a public health background. You mentioned also that there's a lot of turnover in our federal delegation, and this could be a unique opportunity as well. Maryland has never elected an Asian American to Congress at the federal level, ever. And I think this could be groundbreaking if I'm able to attain this office to show that the 7 or 8% of Asian Americans that comprise the population of Maryland finally have representation in Congress as well.
Obviously, you know, you have great expertise in the field of healthcare. You also do a lot of oversight work in the Maryland General Assembly. If you get to Congress, what committees would you like to serve on?
So as you mentioned, the oversight work is really important. I recognize that oversight is the third leg of the three-legged stool of one, putting together and sponsoring legislation, number two, passing a budget, but number three, the oversight piece is a check on the other two, making sure that the laws that you pass are being implemented in accordance with your intentions, and two, making sure that the budget is being used in accordance with how those priorities were allocated out. So oversight, the oversight committee would be one. I think the Energy and Commerce Committee, which also has jurisdiction over all of health-related matters, is another one. And the third one I would say is the Armed Services Committee. When we look at Maryland, which has Fort Meade, Aberdeen, and the like, we currently don't have any representation on the Armed Services Committee, and that's what leads to instances, for example, where we lost our air wing just a couple of weeks ago that will now be converted over. And so it's important to have diversity and representation. And fortunately, in Congress, you're able to serve on more than one committee, and those would be the ones that I would hope to be able to serve on.
And when we come back after a quick break, we'll talk about some of the legislative issues that you may be facing as a member of the House of Representatives. Senator Clarence Lamb represents Howard and Anne Arundel counties in the Maryland General Assembly. He is a candidate to fill the 3rd District congressional seat, which will be vacated when Representative John Sarbanes retires next year. You can join us when we come back, 410-662-8780. You can email us at midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR. I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vinsay.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the author and former Baltimore Sun columnist Kevin Cowherd joins me to talk about his new novel, The Gym. It's a funny exploration of a quirky subculture. Plus, opening day is just 2 days away. We'll talk Orioles baseball with Kevin and Kyle Goon of the Baltimore Banner. So that's happening tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, we're continuing our series of conversations with the candidates with State Senator Clarence Lamb, who represents District 12 in the Maryland Senate. Senator Lamb is running for Congress to represent the 3rd Congressional District. That district is currently represented by John Sarbanes. It includes all of Howard County and parts of Anne Arundel and Carroll County as well. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org. So, Senator, here's an email from Jason, who basically can't believe that you do everything that you do. He says, you're an active legislator, a program director, a faculty member, and a physician, a father, a husband. I doubt that one person can give the proper amount of attention to all of those jobs at once. Please change my mind, Dr. Lamb. Have you ever had that kind of question? That's interesting. I mean, here you are. You're an accomplished person, and you do a lot of different things. And there, here's a person who says, "Oh no, you're not actually doing all of these things." I don't know. How do you respond to that?
So medicine has taught us to juggle many different things at once, right? And so when we're seeing patients, we're also following up on lab results. We're also ordering tests on others. And so we have certainly learned to work on and juggle many different priorities. That's also the work that we do in the legislature, that the legislature is one where you recognize you have to work on legislation, you have to pass a budget, you have to work on oversight, you have to work on constituent concerns. And so being able to juggle many different priorities is a quality that I have certainly worked on over the last couple of years and have developed a good balance over my 9 years in the General Assembly to continue to see patients, to continue to support my 2-year-old daughter, bringing her to childcare, to be able to support a family, to serve patients, and answer our constituent concerns. We also learned that it's important to have a good staff. Right. And so being able to address constituent priorities and constituent issues really depends on having and managing a good legislative staff, one that really cares about people. And I think the people that you bring to work with you is a reflection of the dedication that you bring to serving the community as well. And so I've brought good people in to make sure that we can continue to support all the priorities that we work on, both in the medical field and also in the legislative area.
Yeah, well, certainly being a legislator takes a team, to be sure. Absolutely. Let's talk about some specific policy issues, and let's start with healthcare. Obviously, you know, your background is there. You were the sponsor of a transgender rights bill here in Maryland this session. Tell us the status of that and why you wanted to put it forward.
So this bill helps ensure that reproductive health care in people's medical records remain private. That last year there was a Trans Health Equity Act that Senator Washington sponsored that passed that ensured that individuals that wanted to get gender-affirming care could do so. However, whether it's abortion care or gender-affirming care, there are parts of people's medical records that may not be fully shielded from other states if they were to move to those other states. And so after Dobbs, I think it's incredibly important to ensure that everyone has privacy in their reproductive health care records. And that's what this bill does. And that bill's already passed the Senate, and we expect it to pass the House as well.
There's also a bill that you supported having to do with access to health care for undocumented immigrants. Tell us about that one.
So that's the Access to Care Act that I sponsored last year and that's moving forward and has passed the Senate already this year. That bill allows people who don't have health insurance to be able to sign up on the state's healthcare exchange system so that they can enroll in health insurance. And this includes individuals who might be undocumented as well. And it also allows people who don't have the means to have additional subsidies, including from the federal government, to be able to support their premiums to cover their health insurance coverage on the exchange. This is a win for everyone, whether you have health insurance or not, because for even for those of us who have health insurance, there are individuals that right now are uninsured that go to our emergency departments that are still able to get care because everyone coming to the emergency department cannot be denied care, but we're all subsidizing the care that they receive. And so we're all paying through our premiums a subsidy to support even those who are uninsured. This is a win-win for both those who are insured and those who are uninsured by making sure that if you don't have health insurance, that you can sign up on the health exchange and also afford to do so.
What do you say to people who say, well, that's just subsidization under a different guise? I mean, if you're subsidizing the cost of their health insurance, it's the same thing as subsidizing their health insurance if they show up to the emergency room. You know, we should not be giving people who've entered the country perhaps illegally any government subsidy, the federal level, state level, anywhere. They're against subsidizing people who come in, you know, who are not documented.
It will actually help save the state money, and it will help reduce the wait times that we're seeing in our emergency departments. We've heard that Maryland is one of the last states when it comes to emergency department wait times. Our wait times are skyrocketing and extremely high. And this will help ensure that these individuals aren't using the emergency department as their primary care clinic, that they can go and see a regular primary care doctor and not have to clog up our emergency departments. But ultimately, they will receive better care with a primary care doctor getting the medications that they need so that it doesn't end up in our emergency departments, it doesn't end up in our hospitals, and doesn't end up clogging up our healthcare system, in the end costing our state even more.
Let's talk about juvenile justice. You proposed an amendment to the Senate version of that bill. There's a Senate version and a House version that they're trying to work out. I talked to someone close to that situation just yesterday, saying that it doesn't even really perhaps have to go to conference. It can just simply be the details can be worked out and some sort of bill can end up on Governor Moore's desk. Talk about the need for a juvenile justice reform act this year, having the legislature having just done one a couple of years ago, and the amendments that you in particular proposed.
Yeah, the amendments are a good governance amendment. And the background here is that a few years ago, the legislature passed legislation to enact juvenile justice reform. And the intent here is to help improve rehabilitation of individuals that might, particularly juveniles, that might otherwise end up in a criminal justice system. That we recognize that if someone is a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, the intent is really to help them get back to being productive members of society, education, rehabilitation, and the like. That bill, as it passed through, we've now found could use some additional tweaking, right? And that's where good governance comes in. We found that oftentimes our law enforcement might not be talking to our state's attorney's offices as well as they could be, that people that could otherwise file concerns about individuals that might need help, those concerns may not actually reach juvenile services. And so the amendment that I sponsored will require law enforcement to file those notifications to juvenile services to let them know that there is a child or a juvenile in need of support. And so this is a good governance measure to be able to increase the communication between different agencies and departments. And that's what we look for as legislators, to help improve legislation that may have been passed a couple years ago. But those are policy issues that I think are really important to take a close look at. And that's what I've always done, is to sink my teeth into policy to find areas where there's a need for improvement or there's really a need for leadership.
410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. It's Conversations with the Candidates. My guest is Senator Clarence Lamb. He's a candidate in the 3rd Congressional District for the Democratic primary, which takes place on May 14th. Our email, midday@wipr.org. One of the great chasms between the left and the right sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill and state legislatures as well, is the general approach to public safety. Republicans, we certainly saw this with Governor Hogan during his two terms, tend to propose things that stiffen sentences, that make mandatory sentencing part of the equation, that take discretion away from judges and put it in the hands of lawmakers. Democrats fairly inclined most of the time, to take a sort of holistic approach, to worry about the causes of root crime, the root causes of people engaging in criminal behavior. How do you see the national climate for federal legislation about public safety? This is something, crime, immigration, and the deficit are the three things we hear over and over from your colleagues on the other side of the aisle. When it comes to public safety, when it comes to crime, how do you judge the climate in the country at large and in the third district in particular in terms of how to solve the challenges?
So it's a good question. Public safety is incredibly important for our communities. I'm fortunate that in Howard County, Columbia and Ellicott City has been recognized as one of the safest cities in Maryland. And we want it to continue to be that way. But all across the third district, this is an important priority. And I think there's a lot that we can do from the federal government. We've done, for example, a lot here in Maryland when it comes to gun safety. We've added additional funding to state police to be able to track gun crimes. We've increased the penalties for gun-related incidents. But when we continue to hear across the nation mass shootings that are occurring almost every single day, at July 4th parades, at Super Bowl parades, there is something wrong that's taking place here with the epidemic of gun violence that we continue to see. And while we've made a lot of progress here in Maryland with red flag laws, with banning bump stocks, by prohibiting firearms in safety-sensitive locations like churches and schools and libraries and polling locations, a lot of that still is undone either by the Supreme Court or haven't moved ahead, for example, the assault weapons ban at the federal level. And so we know that what happens in states like Texas and Florida when it comes to firearms affects us here in Maryland. And that's why it's incredibly important to be able to step up into this role to continue the work that's not yet finished at the federal level. And I hope to be able to do that as a member of Congress.
You're a child of immigrants. You're the first AAPI leader of the Howard County delegation in the Maryland General Assembly. You're part of the leadership of the AAPI caucus in the Maryland Senate. Your experience as, being from an immigrant family, how will that inform? Why is that an advantage to the voters in the third district when it comes to immigration policy, which again is another one of those great chasms that we have between the left and the right in the United States?
So immigration is incredibly important. We're a nation of immigrants. It's why almost every single family have had descendants that came from elsewhere. And so we do need to do more to support common sense immigration reform. Our immigration system is broken these days. I think that's a recognition that's occurring across the aisle. We have done a lot here in Maryland. For example, I sponsored legislation called the Maryland Dream Act to allow everyone who's paying taxes to be able to qualify for in-state tuition. I sponsored legislation, as you mentioned, the Access to Care Act that allowed everyone to be able to sign up for health insurance. We put restrictions in place to make sure that our driver's license photos that are in the database with the Motor Vehicle Administration are not being shared with Homeland Security so that no one's privacy is being violated. But I think there's more that we have to do at the federal level. We have an immigration system where there simply aren't enough visas, for example, available for people that might have subject matter expertise to be able to move and come here. There aren't enough work permits available for individuals that want to take up jobs here that are vacant and that would support many of our small businesses and local businesses here. We have dreamers whose dreams are tarnished these days because they're not able to have the assurance that they can continue to stay here. We have an asylum system that unfortunately probably does not take into account people's personal experiences and the need for them to be here. We have temporary protected status programs that are in need of revision too. And so there's a lot that I think can be done, and it helps to have some someone who is a son of immigrants, to be able to bring that perspective to immigration reform. And unfortunately, we were close to a bipartisan immigration compromise that was working its way through the U.S. Senate just through a couple weeks ago. And it was years in the making. And with just a few words from the former president, unfortunately, it was not even going to be taken up for a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives. And that's really unfortunate. That's where we see a lot of the partisanship break down when it comes to be able to support good common sense policies.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. You're talking about a bill sponsored or helped, largely crafted by a very conservative senator, Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma. It doesn't look like there's any possibility of a breakthrough in that regard in the near future, certainly. If you're elected to Congress and you show up in the House and you're sworn in January, what do you do as an individual member of a 435-person body to move the needle on something like that?
So I think it begins by having a conversation about what priorities are important. And even that bill was a combination of different priorities. It was a priority to try to find common ground on immigration reform, but also linked to Ukraine and is funding for Israel and Gaza. And so when you are able to find areas where you can bring policies together to be able to bring a coalition of legislators who are willing to support important priorities like that, I think that's where you have to really take that approach of listening to people, being able to understand where they're coming from, recognize that this is not simply about personal attacks, double down on looking at good policies rather than just trying to figure out how to score political points. But that takes someone who, you know, is willing to kind of put that time in to build those relationships, be a good listener, understand where people are coming from, and find those areas of common ground.
Let me talk about one of those common ground areas. You mentioned that the personal privacy concerns have to be balanced, and there's a tension, perhaps, between personal privacy concerns and the concerns of law enforcement. You talk about immigration policy that have, you know, local law enforcement officials sharing information with HHS, the Department of Homeland Security. HHS isn't Department of Homeland Security, DHS. Forgive me. People hear that. And they say, well, that doesn't make sense. That means, you know, the law enforcement isn't cooperating with each other. And if there are bad people, ill-intentioned people, and the vast majority of immigrants are not ill-intentioned, to be sure, the vast majority are not criminals. What Mr. Trump says about that is outrageous and just plain malicious and wrong. But for those people who do commit crimes when they are here and their status is undocumented, why not have everybody share whatever information they have about it so that those people can be apprehended, deported, whatever? I mean, people hear that and they say, that just doesn't make sense. We should have every agency coordinating with every other agency. How do you respond to that?
And I believe that happens. When there are violent crimes that take place, the agencies do talk to each other. But the bill, for example, that I introduced and passed is a broader bill to address privacy for everyone. That if you get a driver's license and your photo is on file with MVA, I don't think you're expecting them to run facial recognition on your photo. That was not a policy decision that was set by the General Assembly. That was not a policy discussion that was had with a broader community. And we know that people of color, for example, have driver's license photos that when used against facial recognition are more fraught to be or have higher rates of error. And that's not fair for even people that are not immigrants or people that are documented or here legally. And so we need to have that conversation when it comes to policies that affect everyone. And that's why that legislation that I sponsored was really a privacy bill. It was a privacy bill that aimed at everyone because no one, I think, knew it up to that point that their driver's license photos could be scanned for facial recognition purposes by the federal government.
Senator Clarence Lamb, he's running in the Democratic primary to succeed John Sarbanes in the 3rd Congressional District. We'll have more with Senator Lamb when this edition of Conversations with the Candidates continues after a quick break. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.com. Lamb.org. We'd love to hear your questions and comments for Dr. Lamb. And before we go to a break, each week here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 47 people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city. Two men were killed last week in Baltimore. They are Michael Chacon Nataran, age 21, and Christopher Yancey. He was also 21 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Representatives John Sarbanes and Dutch Ruppersberger are two of nearly 50 members of Congress who have announced their retirement this year. Now, each member of the House and Senate who's leaving is doing so for his or her own reasons, but frustration with the legislative process, which is frequently disrupted by extreme members in the majority caucus in the House, is surely a contributing factor to this mass exodus. If you've just joined us today, it's another installment in our series of Conversations with the Candidates. My guest is Maryland Senator Clarence Lamb. He has represented Anne Arundel and Howard counties in the Senate since 2019. He's running in the May 14th primary election to become the Democratic nominee in the 3rd Congressional District, the seat that's currently held by Representative Sarbanes. Several of Senator Lamb's colleagues in the Maryland General Assembly will also be on the ballot in May. That list includes Senator Sarah Elfrith of Anne Arundel County, Delegate Terry Hill of Howard County, and Delegates Mark Chang and Mike Rogers of Anne Arundel County. Harry Dunn, a former Capitol Police officer, has also announced his candidacy, as has Anne Arundel County businessman Juan Dominguez. In all, 22 Democrats will be on the ballot in May. 9 Republicans are vying for their party's nomination in District 3 as well. So as I've said before, as much as Congress is derided in public opinion polls, there's no shortage of people who aspire to join its ranks. Senator Lamb is with me today until the top of the hour. And to join our conversation, you can give us a buzz at 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wypr.org. Let's talk a little bit about foreign policy. You mentioned that funding for Israel and aid to Gaza is tied up with the immigration bill that was snuffed out by former President Trump. I'm not sure what the solution is to that. But when it comes to Israel, we are Israel's strongest ally, and each day it seems that the public support from the administration and members of the legislature, the federal legislature, tends to attenuate bit by bit. We've got Chuck Schumer calling for new elections and a new prime minister. We've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's kind of the de facto head of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, using the word genocide to describe what's going on in Gaza at the hands of the IDF. Your take on what's going on in Israel and Gaza, let's start with them, and what the United States should do about it.
It's an important issue. And obviously what happened on October 7th is just horrific. It's a real tragedy and it cannot be allowed to happen again. Israel does have a right to exist and defend itself. And we also recognize that Hamas is a terrorist organization whose sole mission is to destroy Israel. But I think over the last few months, there have been a lot of angst that's come forward when it comes to ensuring that we're trying to minimize civilian deaths, for example, and restoring humanitarian aid. And really trying to prioritize getting the hostages out. When you think about how long they've been held hostage, it's almost 6 months now that these individuals have been separated from their families. And all the while, tens of thousands of civilians who have not been involved in some of the atrocities that were carried out were killed, and that's unacceptable as well. And then there, as we continue to hear from the news these days, there's hundreds of thousands of individuals who are at risk of starvation. And that's why the U.S. is now going in to try to figure out how to get basic humanitarian aid through a temporary port. And so, you know, I do believe that we should support a mutual ceasefire that's paired with the simultaneous release of all hostages and ensure that there's proper humanitarian aid going in, as well as support to help the rebuilding of Israel and Gaza as a result of the destruction that's going on. And so I think that's a starting place for discussion. I think I just saw that the UN today passed a resolution along similar lines. The U.S. actually chose chose not to vote, and that allowed that resolution to go forward through the Security Council.
Senator Chris Van Hollen did propose some weeks ago a humanitarian ceasefire that lasted maybe as long as 6 weeks. He received a letter from more than 70 members of the Jewish community here in Maryland opposing that idea, saying that that's basically throwing up a white flag, that that's stopping the effort to eliminate Hamas militarily, and that no one would expect anybody else to stop had they been attacked in the way that Hamas attacked Israel. So there's a schism even within the Democratic Party and with people who are often, you know, like-minded on a number of different issues about the kind of control that the U.S. should try to exert over Israel's military strategy. How do you respond to those members of the Jewish community that signed that letter?
I think first and foremost, we need to try to get the hostages back. And I think that's the priority that many folks, including President Biden, have recognized. And so if we are able to negotiate a cessation of hostilities contingent on making sure that we get those hostages back who have been there for over 6 months, while also trying to press for a negotiation for a durable peace in the region, all of that is incredibly important as a starting point. And until we can get to that point of getting those hostages back and getting the priorities focused on their release, we're going to be in a very difficult place to be able to navigate these issues. And so I think it's important for us to really lean on our allies to support a release of these hostages so that we can help rebuild and also support humanitarian aid that needs to come in.
In terms of Ukraine, how do you make the argument to those in the current Congress, the Speaker Johnson in particular, who doesn't even bring a Ukraine vote or an Israel-Gaza vote to the floor because, he says, because of immigration? And there is a House bill that, you know, he says he wants to push instead of the Senate bill. But is it in the United States' best interest to continue to support Ukraine militarily?
It is in the U.S.'s best interest to support Ukraine militarily. Ukraine has been going on through a two-year-plus war with Russia, and they're essentially fighting a proxy war for the West. And we and the U.S. and our allies should stand with them in making sure that they have the support and the resources they need to be able to fight against a war that was brought on them and all the atrocities that have come with it. And so it's important for us to stand with our allies because that sends a message to the world whether we're willing to stand with those whom we support or not. And while it's been a long time and there have been a lot that's taken place since Russia first invaded Ukraine, we need to see them through and be with them through this fight.
Let's talk about term limits. There are people in this race in the Democratic primary who support term limits. We heard just last week from Congressman Mike Gallagher, a congressman from Minnesota, a Republican, that he will be retiring before his term ends. He's leaving the House sometime next month. Right now, it looks like the Republican majority is, you know, they've described it as razor thin for a long time, but now it's one vote. I mean, it's about as thin as the razor ever gets. Do you think, term, you served in the House of Delegates, you served in the Maryland Senate. Do you think term limits for legislators is a good idea?
I would be cautious about term limits for legislators. I think they may make a little more sense for executive branch or executive elected officials, such as the president or county executive or governor. I think for legislators, we try to let voters decide. We're folks that are coming from the people. We represent people. And we're oftentimes very present in our communities. And voters can decide what to do every single election, whether to send a legislator back in their role or not. And I think imposing artificial term limits on people could impact good people who are serving their community and really lessen the experience of effective legislators to be able to serve in Congress or the General Assembly. And that loss of experience could be really impactful by allowing lobbyists or special interests to actually have more power and authority over these types of legislative bodies.
In terms of economic development for the 3rd District, what's the role of the federal government? I mean, generally speaking, philosophically, what do you see the role of the federal government being in terms of economic development for local businesses and the local economy?
So I think the federal government can support things like ensuring that we have a strong education system so that we have individuals that can go on to take on these jobs in the future. The federal government can ensure that there's proper aid to state government and small businesses who may be experiencing times of crisis. So, for example, in Ellicott City and Howard County, many of them experienced 2 floods in just a span of a few years. And it was the federal government that was there to help them rebuild. It was the federal government who was also there to help support the flood mitigation efforts that are taking place in Ellicott City to ensure that those types of floods aren't happening again. And so whether it's through the environment or education, housing, and childcare, there are programs that the federal government can support through things like Head Start, and also ensuring greater housing affordability that would really impact our local communities, help support workers to be able to take on these jobs, and also help benefit local small businesses.
As we finish up, we have a question from Rick Hutzel, who is a columnist for the Baltimore Banner. We talked a little bit about this at the top of the show, but the way Rick puts it is, how do you break through to voters from the very crowded field of candidates? Harry Dunn, this former Capitol Police officer, reports in Maryland Matter, say he's raised nearly $3 million. You and Senator Elfrith have each raised around $400 to $500. We'll decide or find out how much you actually have raised a little bit later next month. But how does one break through financially, just in terms of what you're going to need, the resources you're going to need to mount a campaign in what's obviously a very competitive race?
That's a good question. We've run competitive primaries before, both in 2014 and 2018, and I've always run grassroots campaigns, ones that rely on regular people to get word out in our communities, ones where we've relied on volunteers and others to be able to knock on tens of thousands of doors for us in these campaigns. And so when we see that there are folks that are able to bring in a lot of dollars, we double down on our ground game, and we really try to get our message out about how we've served the community for the last 9 years, how we've represented parts of Howard and Anne Arundel counties, and how we hope to be able to continue to represent their values in Congress as well.
All right, we're going to have to call it there. Senator Clarence Lamb represents the 12th District in the Maryland General Assembly. He's running in the Democratic primary for the House of Representatives in the 3rd District. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. We'll see you out on the trail.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You can hear all of our conversations with the candidates when you go to our website, wipr.org/midday. Our series continues next week with former Delegate Neil Parrott, who's running for Congress in District 6 in Northwest Maryland. He's a Republican. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Kevin Cowherd and Kyle Goon from the Baltimore Banner will talk about Kevin's new book, The Gym, and we'll talk about baseball. Today is the first day of a new afternoon lineup here on WIPR. Fresh Air is coming up after news at the top of the hour, which will be followed by Here and Now at 2 o'clock. Today on Fresh Air, we'll hear from Carrie Brownstein and Corin Tucker about their band. So stay tuned. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.